You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
Exclusively on Paramount Plus. Get ready to explore like never before.
Swiper, no swiping.
Oh, man.
Swing into action.
We need your help.
Woohoo!
Yay!
With a girl who put adventure on the map.
I don't think I can do it, Dora.
I'll protect you, Boots. Together, we got this.
Todos juntos!
Yay!
Dora, the brand new series. Stream with your family now, exclusively on Paramount Plus.
Episode 65, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. Today's expert is Jennifer Zhang, a woman who escaped from the hard labor camps in China and now reports on what the Chinese government is doing to its citizens and those in Hong Kong. Ms. Zhang was a practitioner of Falun Gong, a peaceful spiritual belief that gained popularity in China in the 1990s. Unfortunately, for Jennifer and tens or hundreds of millions of others, the Chinese Communist Party saw Falun Gong as a threat and cracked down on it. It threw millions into hard labor and re-education camps and uses these political prisoners even today as commodities to sell. Jennifer received her master's in geochemistry from Peking University, married, joined the Communist Party, and had a daughter. After beginning to practice Falun Gong and becoming persecuted, she escaped from prison and eventually sought asylum in Australia, where she was able to eventually retrieve her daughter and make her way to America. Jennifer is the author of two books, starred in a documentary film about China, and reports often on the struggle for freedom in both China and Hong Kong. I trust you will find the first-hand perspective on what it's like to grow up during the Cultural Revolution and survive communism both fascinating and horrifying, as I did. Links for her blog, Twitter feed, books, and film can be found at theparadox.com/065. If you haven't already done so, please leave a review, written if possible, on your podcast player, and don't forget to subscribe to the show. But without further ado, Jennifer Zhang on Communist China and its crackdown on Hong Kong and minorities. Enjoy. Well, thank you so much. I'm here with my friend, new friend, Mrs. Jennifer Zhang. She's a Chinese national originally, and she's now been living in the United States after escaping Communist China. And we're going to talk about the story that she has to better understand what's going on in Hong Kong and what's going on in China. And to understand, I guess, really, what when I talked earlier in episode 17 about the forced organ harvesting. And so I wanted to try to better understand these things. And I think there's no one better than someone who's actually lived those. So, Mrs. Zhang, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to start, I guess, for you to tell a little bit about your story and how you got to the point where you got in trouble, which is, as I reviewed your Wikipedia page, is 1997. So why don't you talk about your early life and sort of how you got to the point where the story sort of begins?
I was born in the year when the Cultural Revolution started. That's 1966. Actually, ever since the Chinese Communist Party, which we were referred to as the CCP, in our future conversation. So ever since the CCP took power in China, it started to persecute different parts of the society. So it launches a different political campaign every 10 or 7 or 8 years. So during the Cultural Revolution, because my father was an intellectual, which belongs to the bad class by the definition of the CCP. So he was relocated from a bigger city to a very small town, which had only 30,000 population. So my childhood was spent with my father in that small little town alone, and my father was not allowed to live with my mother together. So my mother was living in another very small village. She taught in a primary school in that small village. So she and my two sisters lived there, and I and my father lived in another place. It took many years for our family to be able to live together. So during the Cultural Revolution, life was very difficult for our family because our class, we belong to the wrong class. So I remember as a child, I was even allowed, I was very reluctant to play with other kids because if we kids had started a fight, it could be regarded or looked at as a class struggle between the intellectuals or bad class with the working class, which is a good class in China by definition then. So my childhood spent in loneliness and kind of being discriminated from the whole society. So that life was very difficult during that period of time.
Did you have a lot of contact with your mother's family? So you were separated from your two sisters and your family just split in half. How did did you have much contact or able to see each other?
Yes, we tried to visit each other during my mother, she taught in the school, so she had some holiday school breaks up. So I remember my father and I traveled to my mother, or my mother traveled to us just to visit us. I actually wrote a story, the story of my father. If you search for the story of my father and Jennifer Zinn, you could read that article and know how life of that period is. My mother almost, I think, tried to divorce my father because life was just too difficult to live like that. So I wrote about those stories in that series of article.
Oh boy. And why don't you describe what it meant to be a Communist Party member? Because I know that part of your bio mentions that you're a member, and how that affected, going to school and getting your training.
Yes, in China, the party is the absolute, controlling of the party is the absolute ruler of everything. So ever since we were born, we were taught that the party was always glorious, always correct, always, great. So to join the Young Pioneers and the Youth League and then the party seems to be the only correct way for one to walk through if you want to do well in this society. So everybody was virtually forced to join the party, whether you want to or not, to join the Young Pioneers as young as 6 years old. Everybody who enters the primary school has to join the Young Pioneers, which means you are at the initial stage on your way to becoming a party member. Then in your teenager, in your middle school, you have to join the Youth League. And then in your university or after you, when you become an adult, you try to become a member of the party. Because, that's the whole environment of the society, because I was always very obedient. I did very well with my study. So I always believed that was the way to go if I want to do well in this society. So I asked or applied to join the party when I was in, I think, the second grade in my university. So that's how it happened to me, yeah.
And so then you got your degree in, you're a science major in, I think it was biochemistry. What happened then? You had a family, correct?
Yes. I married when I was, I think, still a graduate school, and I had a daughter. And during childbirth, I encountered two very severe hemorrhage and lost a lot of blood. I almost died too. I was twice in very critical condition. Yes. Then I couldn't work, I think, for several years until in 1999, I got a set of books of Falun Gong from my family back in Sichuan province, and I read those books and I found them very good. I started practicing this called Falun Gong, which is a very ancient mind-body-spirit practice that was very popular in China then. So I got recovered very, very quickly, like a miracle, only within a month of daily exercise. You know, that I couldn't recover from my illness or very bad, health problems for several years. The practice of Falun Gong really, really helped me.
I see. So it was this Falun Gong, which I talked about in episode 17. It's a spiritual practice, I guess. It's not probably an organized religion, right? It's more of a spiritual practice, and that helped you. It just helped you recover from the ailments you were suffering from, and what. What got you involved in, what made you think about it? Is just because there were a lot of people doing it, and so you thought you'd try that, or how did you come upon it, I guess?
Yes, actually, that is quite, I think, profound. You know, I studied science in university, since I was a university student, I started to ask questions like many philosophers had asked before: who am I, why am I here, where am I going? So I also started to ponder about the purpose of human life, and a lot of questions towards human life, towards university, and I always wondering if there is an ultimate truth in this universe. I somehow believed that there was. If there was not, I don't think the university can maintain its stability and harmony. So I tried to seek for that ultimate truth. I read a lot of philosophy books, Western and Eastern, Asian and modern, and a lot of religious books. I even studied the books of changes, I even became very good at predicting things with the techniques I learned from the books of changes. So for me, it's a very profound spiritual searching since my university days. But I read all those books, they're out there, but still, every time I read, I came upon a new theory, I became very excited. But somehow, after a period of time, those things faded away. I felt I was still puzzled by all these questions I had. But the set of books of Falun Gong somehow gave me very satisfactory answer to all my questions. So for me, it's a more spiritual thing. So the health benefit is just a side product of my practice of Falun Gong, but it's many spiritual, more spiritual meaning for me.
Right. No, so it's a metaphysical yearning you had to try and, like you said, philosophers have been trying to decide, why am I here? Who am I? And what's my purpose? And what's the purpose of, everything, right?
Yeah.
And so by finding those answers, it probably just helped the other things in your life sort of fit together and work better. I want to back up a little bit and talk about your father. So you were, the government, the Chinese Communist Party, separated your family and made your life very difficult. You worked very hard in school, but what was his feeling on the party? Did you two talk about it much? Did you have a different sort of view of what the party was like and how they were in the government? And did you have a negative view of them, or were you sort of, well, that's, they're just doing what their best they can, and so what happened to our family was supposed to happen?
Okay, I I'm pretty much sure you will be surprised by this. because in China, talking about politics is very, very dangerous. So my sure. father and I, in our whole life, never discussed politics at home. Uh-huh. So I remember, as I said, when I was a child, you know, during Cultural Revolution, all the literary books, you know, especially the Western ones, were destroyed. The Communist Party called them poisonous weeds. So we actually, as a child, I had nothing to read apart from the textbooks in the school, and I have a longing to read more books. So my father actually, because he loved literature, so he wrote novels for me to read, like those revolutionary stories, like Little Red Guards Catch, you know, banned enemy for the party. But as soon as my mother found he was writing something, my mother always, my mother always burned all his writings.
Really?
Because, yeah, it was very, very dangerous. So the only time that I ever heard him talking about something that has a little bit to do with politics was, you know, when 1 year before I was going to sit the admission. It's a national admission test examination for the entrance examination for college. Uh-huh. We need to select whether you want to study science or literature art. So there are two fields to select. So usually they say, oh, girls maybe are better off studying literature arts because their minds are not for science. So I asked my father's opinion. So that was the only time he said something that had something to do with politics. And he said, no matter who is the president or chairman of this country, 1 + 1 = 2. So you study science. So because, you know, he studied politics and law in his university, and he encountered so many bad things during Cultural Revolution, so he did not want me to repeat his mistake. So he insisted on that my choosing science. So I followed, I was very obedient, I followed his instruction. I studied science, geochemistry in particular, and I got a Master of Science, and we all believe at that time we would avoid for having me to get into trouble because I'm out of politics, I'm studying science, 1 + 1 = always, it's always 2. We should not have any problems, but who knows.
But clearly you got into trouble because you sought answers that can't be answered by science and I suppose, well, that led you to Falun Gong. And was there an expectation for people who began practicing Falun Gong? Because what happens next is there's a crackdown by the government, which goes to this day, I believe, right?
Yes.
And were people surprised by this? Why do you think the government did it? Kind of give me an idea for what the environment was like at the time.
Yes, I think it was very, very surprising for me at that time because I think during 1980s, I think especially before the crackdown on Tiananmen massacre, there was a very short period of time when people had a little bit of freedom to search for something, like for what I searched. I after the Cultural Revolution, you know, after the China adopted the opening to the outside policy and the reform. So we actually imported a lot of things from the West. People started talking about learning from the West. People even start talking about, you know, science plus democracy. It's a way for China to go to improve our society. So that, that there was a little bit of window, I think, for several years in the late 70s and during in the 80s. And so there are, I think, more than 2,000 of different Qigong practice booming like in China during that period. So I actually learned a lot, several other Qigong practices before I took up Falun Gong. So, and the government actually encouraged it because, you know, if people practice Qigong, they became more healthy and they save, you know, medical care money for the government. Yeah, so... Right. So there was many positive actually report on Falun Gong, on Qigong, and so that's how that all that's why Falun Gong spread, you know, so fast during only 6 or 7 years since its first introduction to the public in 1992. The number of Falun Gong practitioners actually exceeded that of the Communist Party member. And that's, I think, when and why this practice got into trouble with this one party, within this one party state.
So, I mean, the traditional thinking, when I've heard people talk about religion when it comes to communist governments is, or totalitarian governments, is essentially that the government wants itself to be the center of purpose and not any, and to not be subservient to anything else like a metaphysical, you know, either God or some sort of spiritual practice. And so they see that as a threat to their authority and their potential, their, you know, credibility. And so that's why they crack down, whether these people are actually like revolutionaries or not. That's why they try and stop it. Would you agree that's sort of the thinking maybe?
Yes, I think that's how it worked in China. After the CCP came into power, the first thing it did is to eliminate all the religions. All the religions were not allowed, especially during Cultural Revolution. You know, people had a portrait or picture of Chairman Mao in their family. They worship Chairman Mao every day. Like, he actually replaced all the other gods, all the other religions. The party became the only religion in the world, so in the country. So it's different from, you know, like a normal country. A party is just a party. It can be changed and anyone can establish another party. But in China, this party is the god, is the only religion, and it has replaced every other religion. So of course, it won't allow any other thing to compete for this kind of status of itself. Of course, it wants to crack down on any serious religion. Right now, after the crackdown of Falun Gong, we see they also came after, you know, Tibetan Buddhist mm-hmm. house church right. members and the Uyghurs, because they believe in, they have their own religion, they believe in something else. So anybody who believes in something else has a problem with the party.
So you're part of the Falun Gong, and then explain what happens to you, because you get taken to prison, I assume, and how does that whole process work out, and then what happens to your family in this whole thing, ordeal as well?
That, you know, everything turned upside down since the day of the crackdown happened. I was arrested 4 times and then sent to a labor camp and then tortured very badly, nearly to death during that period. And my sister was also given 18 months in the labor camp because she also practiced Falun Gong. And I had to escape from my family only 5 days of my release. And since then, I was wandering around the hiding in the country for several months, and then I was lucky enough to escape China, but all my family was left inside China. So still to this day, the National Security Department are having regular talks with my family mm-hmm. members. You know, yeah, so everything was turned upside down for the whole family, for everybody in the family.
Did you escape with your child?
I actually escaped alone, and I sought asylum in Australia. And after I got my refugee status, I was lucky to be able to get my daughter to join me in Australia. That was in, you know, 2004. She actually joined me exactly 3 years after I was released from the labor camp. So in this case, or in this sense, I was much, much luckier than many of my fellow Falun Gong practitioners who had not had the opportunity to escape China and who are still suffering there. That's why I'm trying to speak out every time I can.
It is really hard for people, and I feel personally, I feel really bad that I didn't, that I was unaware of sort of the human rights abuses that are occurring in China. And the organ, when I first heard about the organ harvesting, I thought there's no way this could be true, right? Because if, especially the scale is so large, it's not like there are a couple hundred people who this is occurring to. Mm-hmm. We're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, a million people that this has happened to. It's inconceivable that something at this large scale, because as much of a big deal we make about the Holocaust and other, you know, horrible atrocities or what happened in Rwanda, I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, genocides, and yes, that it's a big deal. Yet no one talks. I mean, I shouldn't say no one. There are definitely instances you can find in the press, but it's sort of happening, but no one ever talks about it. I don't understand.
Yes, I think if we want to explain this, this comes to a whole very, very big topic and a very serious one. It's related to Hong Kong. It's related to what's happening in the US and in the world. The Communist Party actually had a very big ambition, you can say, to conquer the world. It was in writing in the Communist Manifesto. In hundreds of years ago, they declare in that 19 maybe 18 something year, I forgot which year, declared in the manifesto the purpose of the Communist Party or the communism is to demolish all existing social order and is establish a new order for the world. Maybe nobody took it serious today, but they still took it very serious. Only maybe sometimes they talk about it, sometimes they don't. So at least in China, they had this very, very tight control of everything. So all the media is controlled, all the society, all the system is controlled. So it is very, very hard to any kind of this kind of bad information to get out of China. And I think sadly, they somehow took the advantage of the loopholes in the West after they were allowed to join WTO. They used money investment coming from the West to become rich, and then they used the money back to control the world. We just saw the controversy of the NBA episode of somebody, Morey corrected. So that's how they are working. They are using the money. If the powerful guys, the rich people as an NBA star can be controlled or kowtowed to the party, you imagine it is actually what happened. They use the money to try to bought over, I think, to try to buy over many politicians, big multinational companies, because they want the Chinese market, they go to China, and they actually help the party to monitor and to crack down on the people. They give them the technology, like the internet, great firewall of the internet. They got the technology from Cisco. So the West is not only not helping to spread the truth, they're helping the party to crack down. And many media companies, major media companies shut themselves up. If this is too sensitive to the party, somehow everybody is in their subconscious practicing self-censorship. Even I think the previous US government, you know, for many, many years, they even dare not to openly raise the issue or say the word about human rights when they visit China, when they meet with the CCP leaders. So that's how these millions of people are being murdered and their organs sold, and the world, like you said, still knows so little about what's happening. If we still not, try to wake up, now this thing is moving. They are, because they are very successfully to suppress this, Falun Gong. If such a large group can be silenced, can be suppressed like this, they move their, like you can say, front room little by little, from within China now to Hong Kong, and the next step is where you can imagine.
Yeah, right. I mean, as you said, they're leveraging their market and the opportunities to make money for the multinational corporations and for the U.S. government, right? It's funny because you always hear people, you'll hear it just sort of vague, generalized, well, they're human rights abuses. And that's all you'll hear. You won't know what they're talking about when you hear the controversy that is the president going to address human rights abuses. But that's like all you hear. You don't hear actually what it is.
Yes.
It's completely different of saying someone can't write a book versus you were going to, shoot someone in the head and take their organs and sell it to people. I mean, people, I think, would have a much more visceral reaction to one and I think rightly be sort of find it abhorrent and be much more concerned about it than some vague sort of civil loss of civil liberties, which I think are important. But certainly when people talk about, again, just the euphemism, human rights abuses, it covers so many things. It's hard to really, it doesn't have a meaning because you don't actually know what the act is.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you would say absolutely this is happening. Like,
yes.
The organs, how do they do it? I mean, I get just in general, do they just get a blood sample and they just keep you in prison, or do they get a blood sample, just let you roam the streets and whenever they need it, they come pick you up? Sort of like an open air prison?
I think it happened little by little. In the, as early as the 1960s, there were maybe just very separate or individual cases, like they murdered or they executed somebody as anti-revolutionist, and then those ladies' organ got removed, and then they put it, they use them in organ transplants. And then I think in 80s and 90s, the Chinese Communist Party has always been doing this to executed prisoners. So it's a common practice. Their thinking is, you are bad people. You are, sentenced to death.
Yeah.
And why not just harvest your organ to save somebody and to make some money, to make some usage of your useless self? So for them to do this kind of thing, have no mental barrier or moral code, constraining them, because their atheism, and they don't think human has human dignity or human rights. They regard humans as a flesh, body is still alive. If you die, you die. And they regard you as a piece of material. So if they want to make use of this material, why not? So I believe after the crackdown of Falun Gong, because they can round up so many people, detain them, and then to harvest, organs from executed prisoners, to harvest somebody or kill somebody alive on demand for his organs, is just one step further for them. So mentally, they have no problem. But of course, technically, they need to have the technology. Again, the West medical society is helping them to train a lot of organ transplant doctors. So the bottleneck for them to boom this transplant industry, you can say, is, well, of course, they have enough doctors, and second and most importantly, they have enough organ suppliers. So after the crackdown of Falun Gong, because millions of people were arrested and detained either in labor camp, in detention center, in some kind of legal school or in prison. They started, I believe, from very, very early on. I was in the camp in 2000. That was just less than a year since the crackdown happened. I was, you know, forced to go over, you know, to undertake medical exams, not only once but twice, and everybody had the blood test, had the blood test in the labor camps. So I believe they started to do this systematically as soon as the crackdown on Falun Gong began. So everybody in the camp, especially Falun Gong practitioners, got our blood and whatever, you know, they gave us very thorough physical checkup. So they store, I believe, our data in the computer system. They must mm-hmm. have a data system. So anyone need an organ, they just search for a match in that database. If anybody was a match, that person can be killed on demand. And this is the only way to explain the very sharply increased the organ transplant numbers, which is done in China every year. And this yeah. is the only reasonable way to explain that a shockingly short waiting period. There are so many evidence that they only, I think even in the hospital's website, they openly promise you that you they can find a match for you within two weeks. And it's, yeah. yes. So that if you put all these things, these figures, these dots together, the only reasonable conclusion is they are killing people on demand and on a very, very large scale. Right now, I think the China Tribunal has just issued a verdict in June this year. And I think there are very, very solid evidence. As long as someone, is willing to spend a little bit of time to read those material, everybody will be convinced of that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I when I talk to other physicians I'm with, you know, that most of them haven't heard of this either, and they're shocked and amazed that this is occurring. And yeah. one of the questions I always get is, well, I mean, how do you know they don't have a sophisticated donor network like in this country? You know, if someone dies from an accident in Salt Lake City and they have a heart and it matches someone who's waiting for a heart in, say, Boston, they will fly a plane out. Retrieve the organ and then take it back to Boston and transplant it. My understanding is that sort of system doesn't exist in China, and that also there's not any sort of large list of people who are willing to donate organs, and that's because it's like a cultural, it's a cultural thing to be buried whole with all your organs. Is that accurate?
Yes, actually, before 2015, there's no donation system at all. It's not like the U.S. Yeah, whenever okay. somebody, you know, got a drive license, they ask you whether you want to become a donor, and you are got listed. And there are two, you know, one waiting list and a donor list. So there are two lists, a very, I think, well-established system in the U.S. and in many Western countries as well. But in China, everything is in a dark place. They don't have a waiting list. They don't have a donor list. And like you said, it is against Chinese culture to donate your organ. Somehow, Chinese believe you need to keep your body as a whole. So nobody actually wants to donate. Maybe things change a little bit now, but virtually there is no such a system in China. And because of this revelation of this organ, live organ harvest issue, they try to say that, oh, they are setting up a system and they'll stop using, you know, prisoners' mm-hmm. organs since 1915. But there are still, I don't trust anything the party is telling us. There are still many loopholes. I actually write an article about a simple math and a shocking reality. If you compare what they claim of the numbers of registered dollars to the organ or to the actual transplant they did, to the numbers of what they ratio in America, you have a ratio if you compare the the registered donors to the actual transplant happened. In China, they have maybe thousands of a higher rate, which means they only need maybe 100 registered donors to do one transplant. While in America, you might need 300,000 something. Yeah, so right. you need to question that very simple math. Every I think fourth grader can do a math to compare, and you need to explain why the ratio has so huge gaps there. So the whole system of the so-called donation system is just a fake thing. So don't trust it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear. I think there are dozens, if not over 100, transplant hospitals that all they do are transplants in the country.
Yes,
and they even report on their websites. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of transplants, and if you have no sophisticated system, then there's only one explanation that you're getting from people against their will. And I think there was a recent expose done by a South Korean news station in maybe November of 2017, and I linked this to back in my episode 17, where they go in, they basically go with hidden cameras, amazing that they are able to sort of pull this off, but. They went to hidden cameras and are talking to nurses and doctors about, you know, and meeting patients who are waiting for the kidneys or whatever organ it is, and sort of openly talking about how much it costs. And if you want to be put to the front of the line, it's going to be an extra, you know, $5,000 or whatever.
Yes.
But it's very, I mean, I guess my understanding with most of these communist authoritarian governments, there's obviously lots and lots of corruption, are the people who are sort of who hold the prisoners, are they financially benefiting from this, do you think? I mean, I'm trying to figure out how this is happening, because I imagine that the government knows it's happening but doesn't really stop it because it's bringing in capital so that they can then use it in other places in the government. But do you think people are sort of various levels of officers who are in charge of the hospitals and the, you know, whatever, they're actually pocketing some of this and becoming enriched personally too? Is that how this, you know, including the prison wardens and
Yes, of course. I think you mentioned the documentary. I also watched that documentary. You can see in that just one hospital in Tianjin, they conduct thousands of transplants per year, and they have thousands of people from South Korea alone flying there to do transplants. So, and like you said, you see, you know, a transplant hospitals building big buildings and one by one through those years. Like you said, if you don't have a huge industry to sustain it, why do you continue to build up so many transplant hospitals? And the beds are always full, always have people, you know, there. So it means they really have a huge amount of people waiting to be cured. And also you mentioned the financial benefit. Number one, I think this is definitely a government section of sponsored, you can say, industry. Without the government consensus, this can't be done on such a large scale. And many of them benefited them from the military hospitals and also all the labor camps, and the court even got paid by this, because the court, if they executed somebody, they sentenced somebody to death, and the prisoners, detention centers, labor camps all benefit from it. Actually, when this kind of crime was first exposed by a lady who gave herself and others name Annie back in 2006, she talked about why she discovered this, because she found her husband was actually responsible for removing the cochlea of the people, and her husband has removed the cochlea from more than 2,000 living Falun Gong practitioners. And the reason she found out was she found suddenly there were so much cash in US dollars at her home, and she couldn't figure out why, as a family, they suddenly got so much extra U.S. dollars. And she found her husband was in a very weird kind of situation. He couldn't sleep well. He was often in a, like, not him quite himself. He was got scared, and he got so much extra cash notes of in U.S. dollars, where he couldn't explain the source. And later on, and little by little, he, because he was under too much mental pressure, he disclosed this matter to her. And then that's why they decided they want to escape China to tell the world what's happening, because she said at that time there were 6,000 Falun Gong practitioners detained in the underground facilities of her hospital, and 2,000 of them already got killed. And she said if she exposed this, those remaining 4,000 could be saved. But unfortunately, I think the Chinese Epoch Times and the New Tang Dynasty TV maybe were the only two media outlets which had the courage to report what she said back in 2006. None of the major media reported about them. So she made such a sacrifice. She always got killed, you know, by the CCP when she tried to escape. She used she stood out. If you search for the report in that year, you could still see her voice and her image. So yes, one of the issues she found out what's wrong inside this family was the money. She said something like 300,000 US cash in her family. So yes, all the doctors, that's how they are willing to do it. They are bought over. They all, you know, everybody has some blood on your hands. So you keep quiet and you benefit from it.
So I know, you know, if you go to a lot of U.S. Medical centers in this country and you're looking for transplant surgeons and programs, there are a number of Chinese nationals who are training, you know, to be transplant surgeons. There's lots of research and collaborative research between the United States and China in when it comes to transplant practices, you know, various medications help transplants survive and, you know, all the sorts of medical things that one would do. Mm-hmm. And my contention has been that we should probably not allow any of that because it's invariably it's being used. We're assisting people who are performing atrocities, and that research is not. You know, you wouldn't collaborate with the Nazis when they're researching at Auschwitz, and for the same reason we shouldn't in this country. I guess do these researchers who come to, because you know, I think a lot of them are, I don't know, they're in their 20s, I suppose, or maybe 30. When they come to learn these, do they know when they go back that that's how the transplants occur? I mean, or are they not aware of sort of how the circumstances? What do you think?
I'm not quite sure about the situation about everyone, but I think the majority of, you can say in China, because this organ transplant industry has been totally tarnished by this kind of killing people for the organs practice. And I guess the majority of the doctors who are learning this or who are involved in this, kind of, it's just very common. It's already become very common practice and accepted model for this industry now. So I don't know if there's anybody who is clean or anybody who is not. But overall, this industry, I think, is heavily, heavily tarnished by this, you know, I don't know how to, this at the very least, anti-humanity crime. It's no less evil than the Holocaust, as you mentioned, because millions of people were killed and you know industrialized and treated as a body parts commodity. I think that's just evil beyond the imagination of any normal human being. And I understand sometimes, actually for myself, when I first heard about this, even though I had experienced so much cruelty in the labor camp, I was almost tortured to death. I still found it was very hard for me to believe that this was happening. Because somehow, I later figured out why, because this is too cruel to any normal human being to accept as a reality. And the second question is, if you admit this is happening, you are immediately faced with a moral obligation to do something about it. Yeah. Otherwise, can you call yourself a human being if you know this is happening to your fellow human being and you don't do nothing? So sometimes it is easier to just try to pretend I don't know, because you don't have to deal with this this issue, which is very hard to admit and to deal with.
Yeah, I think that's probably 100% accurate. I imagine even the people who are performing the surgeries, they may know there are people being executed for their organs, but they probably say in their mind, well, these were bad people. They were, you know, prisoners. They broke the law and they were going to be executed anyway. So we're getting some value out of this and it may be helping someone else. And you can certainly find ways to justify what's going on, even though you may know on some level, no, but otherwise you wouldn't be able to sleep. I can't imagine. I mean, unless there aren't that many monsters in the world. I think you couldn't have that many people who are privy to sort of what's going on. Let's shift a little bit to Hong Kong, because I'm really interested in this. And I don't know, I'll admit, I don't know much about it. I know that the UK handed over Hong Kong, its colony, over to China. And that with conditions that China or that Hong Kong would maintain its normal freedoms that it had lived with for, you know, however many years under the British rule for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And that China agreed to this, of course, because, you know, they're going to get Hong Kong and they wanted the money and the economy. But that at some point, the Chinese have decided that they're going to just make a play to say, we're just going to bypass the 50 years, or we're just going to make sure that by the time we get to 50 years, it's sort of already done. We're not going to try and do a cold turkey, you know, from freedom to no freedom. And then we're going to sort of slowly.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's what happened to Hong Kong. The CCP, when the CCP promise you anything, don't believe them whatsoever. let's agree to 50 years, no change. It is very easy for them to make the promise, but they didn't intend to keep the promise in any time. So very, very soon after they got back Hong Kong, gradually they tried to treat Hong Kong little by little, but they definitely want to take over Hong Kong as one of the cities of China. They want to practice their so-called sovereignty. And that means no freedom, because that means the party controls everything. So you see, little by little, the freedom of Hong Kong got the erosion, you know, little by little, and somehow Hong Kong people felt it, that the erosion of their freedom, and then suddenly to some point, they felt enough is enough. If we don't do something now, our children will become slaves of the party forever. That's why so many young people are willing to actually sacrifice their lives to fight against this party. They are fighting for the freedom. And the issue actually is not that complicated. It's very simple. It's a fight between I think liberty or freedom for everything, and become a slave of the CCP system. So I think the same fight actually were it's nothing different from the fight for liberty from everywhere in this world. And because, as we said earlier, this party wants to spread their model, this China, Great China model, with the One Belt, One Road system. And they are actually trying to infiltrate the West little by little. If we don't try to withhold them now, we don't get them in check now, little by little, what happened to Falun Gong practitioners has already, you know, happened to the Uyghurs, and then it was spread. It's now, I think, nearly spent to Hong Kong. They are now using many methods they used against Falun Gong practitioners to people of Hong Kong. And if we lose Hong Kong, and then they will continue to move forward to the rest part of the world, and even could be to the United States. That's why I think Hong Kong is such a great stake. And those people are very great and courageous people, and they deserve our respect, and they deserve our support, and they deserve our help, because they are not defending their own rights, but also defending and have the CCP in check, prevent the CCP from doing more harm to the rest of the world. So this is why the world should be very grateful to what the Hong Kong people are doing. And still, I think it's very sad that with still in Hong Kong, people still have a limited freedom to reporting. You know, reporters can report at a very close distance. Still, there are so many cover-ups. There are so many suspicious, you know, so-called shoe side cases in Hong Kong. And even like the girls, the young females got reports of got raped. One of them, I think, was brave enough to come forward and speak publicly with her real name, and she actually removed her mask when she finished her spoke. So with all this happening, if we still don't, you know, stop the CCP from doing what they are doing, I think I can hardly imagine what will happen next. So although they are not, because they know if they openly use tax and military against Hong Kong people, like what they did in Tiananmen, the world will not allow them to do that. But they are doing it in a more, a covered way and more sinister. They are using, there were reports which I believe to be true, that they are using the CCP military soldiers or armed police to pretend to be Hong Kong police, and they pretend to be protesters, and they create chaos, and so to make excuse for them to impose, you know, you have now tougher laws, like the emergency status was already invoked, and then you have the anti-mask laws. So they are using very heinous and hidden ways to actually really doing very bad thing to the protesters, like got them arrested, more than 2,000 got arrested, and some of them got sexually abused while in detention, and they actually use mobs to attack whoever they think are the leaders, and they try to arrest as many leaders as possible and treat them very badly, but you know, in somewhere hidden, and they don't expose to the world. So the Hong Kong people are actually facing very, very dangerous situation. They got, you know, they are not in Chinese. We are creating a new term, like being shoe-sided, which means the CCP actually murdered them and then declare those people commit suicide. So you have, you know, maybe over 100 so-called suicide cases happened during the past few months when the protesting are happening, or you have found bodies in the sea. And all those could be, you know, people murdered by the party, but declared that they committed suicide. And it is still very hard to get to uncover the truth, even with so much, you know, media presence in Hong Kong, still very difficult for the world to find out. But from what I understand of the nature of the party, I know they can they can do anything. They stop at no evil. So they actually, they have three policies they applied to Falun Gong practitioners. One is to eliminate them physically and bankrupt them financially and damage their reputation. Mm-hmm. And another one is anyone is not held accountable if you kill somebody. It is just counted as suicide. So these are all the policies applied to the Falun Gong practitioners during the persecution. So it's very obvious for us who have experienced this that they are adopting many or some of those kind of similar tactics sure. they used against Falun Gong practitioners to people of Hong Kong.
I mean, it's classic authoritarian crackdown on anyone, right? The problem, of course, for them is that there is that things are coming to light. It's interesting because the tweet that was sent by Daryl Morey it was just a retweet of somebody just said, support freedom, free Hong Kong. It was very innocuous. Yeah. And really, had the Chinese government done nothing, no one would ever have remembered it happened, right? But because they went kind of crazy and they insisted on it coming down and then canceling TV contracts and all this, they showed their hand and sort of, you know, the mask came off briefly and who they really are. And it forces the NBA, and I don't believe this has even come close to being resolved at this point. And I think it's just beginning because all these people are forced to answer it. And it's forcing ordinary Americans to sort of come to terms with what's going on and who the Chinese really are as far as the government. And, I mean, I'm encouraged. It's terrible what's going on in Hong Kong, but I think it's forced people to sort of recognize the influence that China has. And I think in many ways, China does not have as much influence as they think they do, because as much as they can say, well, stop, you know, broadcasting games, in instance of the NBA, they need our cultural exports far more than we need their money. You know, I think that and our market is much larger than theirs still. And so if you were to lose the U.S. market, well, you've lost the NBA, for instance. Or if Hollywood loses any Americans who want to watch the movies, well, they've lost everything. If to get China, you lose everything else, they completely lose out. And so I think I'm encouraged in some ways. I mean, I'm very much a very civil libertarian, and I'm very much in favor of freedom and liberty. And I, you know, applaud people who are willing to die for their freedom. I mean, that's don't know that any of us can say we do that. I mean, we did that a couple hundred years ago, and people from time to time through our history have. But I guess I'm encouraged that it seems to be that there's at least some self-examination and recognition in our country that something's going on and that we probably have to do something about it. I'm disappointed that the president hasn't really come out and said anything about it, because he's, you know, it's the economic interests, right? The trade deals, blah, blah, blah. And so we can't say anything, but my hope is that the spirit of freedoms actually will overcome financial interests that people have, because most people don't really care what's going on in, you know, as far as, you know, sales of tabletops and movies in China. I mean, a few people do, but most Americans don't care. They just want the right thing done. And so that's my hope. And maybe whether it's accurate or not, I'm not sure. It's been a delightful discussion. I really appreciate you coming on. And you know, there are two books that you've written, Witnessing History, One Woman Fights for Freedom in the Falun Gong, which you published in 2006. And then you have the 2013 book, I believe, or 18 book, 2018, It's Still Water Runs Deep. And then is that correct?
Yes, that's a Chinese version of my autobiography. Yes,
okay. that's one that I'm not going to be able to read.
Yes, but the first one you will be able to, and there's also a documentary about my story called Free China, the Courage to Believe.
And that's from 2013. And I think to follow your writings, jenniferzengblog.com. I mean, all these links will be on the paradox.com website, so you can definitely go there and find all these links to the books and links to that. I want to thank you so much and wish you an early happy birthday. I know it's on that Wikipedia that your birthday's in just a couple days, so as we're recording this. And Why don't you leave us with something hopeful, some what you think is going to happen, and I guess where you hope to see things happen the next transpire in the next year, let's say.
Yes, I'm very hopeful that the rightness will overcome evil and in the future, and the endurance of the Falun Gong practitioners, they have been withstanding this persecution for over 20 years now, and they are still there. And now I think the spirit of Hong Kong people also gave us courage. And I think eventually it is a choice of everybody between the right things to do, the freedom, the liberty, and the righteousness, universal principles, between the evil communist parties. I think we should be very clear that this is a choice, and there is no middle ground, and we have to make a stance in front of this huge battle between the evil of the communist specter and the spirit for freedom and liberty. And everybody has to make a stance, and I hope that everybody will choose to stand with liberty and freedom for human rights, and don't side with the evil CCP, and don't kowtow to them.
Well, I think that's a great way to end, and thank you so much for your words of inspiration and for your activism and making sure that everyone's aware of what's going on. So thanks again so much for being on.
Thank you again for having me.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what The Doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.